Hello again, everyone, and welcome to another edition of KHOI Community Radio's Capital Week, your window on the world of Iowa politics, where we explore and analyze who's been making news in and around the state capital, what that news is, and what it all means. I'm Dennis Hart, joined as always by my partner in politics, Laura Bellin of the blog site Bleeding Heartland. Laura, here we are again after our week off on Memorial Day. Welcome.
It's so good to be back, Dennis.
Laura, it is good to be back as well for me. All right, before we get into all the political happenings that took place last week in Iowa, and there were a ton of them, we have to acknowledge the tragedy that unfolded in Davenport, the partial collapse of that apartment building, the deaths of several individuals, the rescue efforts, and the work of some really fine reporters who covered all of this. It was quite a week.
Yes, and it happened on the Sunday of Memorial Day weekend. And unfortunately, we've just learned this past weekend that three people who were unaccounted for were killed in that building collapse in downtown Davenport. I want to recommend that people follow the Quad City Times reporting, and also Iowa Public Radio has done some excellent reporting on this. It's going to be a story that goes on for a long time. And Iowa does have a very old housing stock. There are a lot of buildings in a lot of cities that are very much like that Davenport building that collapsed. So it's something to keep an eye on for sure. But just a very tragic thing. And the collapse had happened in the middle of the night instead of in the late afternoon, the fatalities would have been much higher.
And of course, Laura and I send our very best wishes and hopes to all of those who were affected by this and involved with this.
Yes, and I know that the Red Cross and other aid agencies are really working hard. The state and the city of Davenport are also trying to help the people who were displaced and the people who lost all of their belongings in the collapse.
All right, let's talk about politics. That's the purpose of this broadcast. And last week, Laura, honestly felt like the state had become the center of the political universe. Again, how could it not? Because Republican presidential candidates and soon-to-be candidates literally swarmed into the state, starting with Florida Governor Ron DeSantis, who dropped by first on Tuesday and Wednesday. So let's start with Ron.
Yes, I think everybody knows that it's very important to have a good showing in the Iowa caucuses because it is going to be the first event on the Republican side. And if anybody is going to have a chance of displacing Donald Trump, they're going to have to do well in Iowa. So yes, Ron DeSantis came here. He kicked off his campaign in a church. It was, by the way, we'll get to that in a minute, but there were some questions about whether that was possibly a violation of the church's tax exempt status. But he is trying to walk a line that we've discussed in previous weeks, where he is presenting himself as a strong leader, a more electable alternative, and making some gentle digs at Trump, but not really directly confronting the Trump legacy in his speeches. When he speaks to reporters now, he's starting to be a little bit more negative about Trump. But when he's in front of a Republican audience, we don't really hear that from him.
So the big deal from Mr. DeSantis last week is that he repeatedly framed Florida and Iowa as partners in what he called a Republican crusade for common sense, compared Iowa with Florida, Florida with Iowa, et cetera, et cetera. And as you say, like the other candidates, really not going after Donald Trump directly.
Yes. And I mean, this is a popular line, right? Because Iowa Republicans are really riding high right now. They have historically large legislative majorities. They have total control of the congressional delegation. They just had a very productive legislative session. And so Ron DeSantis is making the case that Florida and Iowa show that you can be successful while pursuing this very conservative agenda. And I think it's something that Iowa Republican audiences will like to hear. Now, I mean, other people might look at this and say, well, different state electorates are very different demographically from Iowa and Florida. And so it doesn't necessarily follow that proposing the same policies is going to work as well in other states as it does politically here. But in any case, DeSantis can say that Florida and Iowa both had red waves in 2022. Most states didn't. And the lesson that he's encouraging people to draw is that that means they're on the right track.
And what was the question about his appearance, Mr. DeSantis's appearance at a church?
Yes, well, there are the IRS has rules about whether a church can get involved in political activities. Most churches obviously are tax-exempt organizations. This was Eternity Church in Clive was where the DeSantis event was. And it's fine for churches to invite candidates to speak. This rally, I read some articles about where they talked to campaign finance experts who said maybe this blurred the line a little bit because it was a campaign kickoff of Kipcock event. There were many, many signs all over the church. The pastor, Jesse Newman, gave very glowing remarks about Ron DeSantis and a prayer for Ron DeSantis. And so it's just questionable. I mean, the IRS doesn't enforce these regulations very much, and I don't know whether anybody is going to try to file a complaint, but this is definitely territory that a lot of churches hesitate to go into. Like, they might invite candidates to come and address the congregation, or they might host a candidate forum, but not exactly a rally like this.
And following Mr. DeSantis, here comes Mr. Trump. He spoke to the Westside Conservative Club in Urbandale on Thursday, then held a Fox News town hall with Sean Hannity. Mr. Trump said, "There's no way we lose Iowa." And honestly, it doesn't appear as if there is a way for Mr. Trump to lose Iowa.
Well, right now, he seems to be in a very commanding position. And Iowa, of course, is a state where Republicans are doing better and better over the last several years. I mean, Trump, it's interesting because Trump has come here a few times. He doesn't tend to stay long when he comes in Iowa. And that's something that a few of the other candidates are trying to emphasize, that they're spending more time talking to people, taking questions, shaking hands, doing events in more towns. But I just don't think that Trump really needs to do that level of retail campaigning because he already has such a strong base of support.
Even before he got to the state, he said last week, a grandiose plan he had. He wants the U.S. to throw a 250th birthday party in 2026, and that Iowa should be in the middle of it with a state fair that would be, the biggest state fair in the history of the world, etc. He's trying to court Iowa, obviously, with all these plans. What do you say?
Yes. Well, I mean, everybody, look, the Republican establishment in Iowa has been really friendly to Donald Trump, even throughout his presidency, when there were times when other Republican leaders in other states tried to distance themselves a little bit from Donald Trump. And that didn't really happen here. So I think that he likes to speak in a grandiose way, right? So that was how I took those remarks. He's got big plans in a lot of areas, and that's one of his big plans. And remember that he had a TV show for a long time. So I think he likes the idea of spectacles and shows.
After those two appearances on Tuesday, Wednesday, and Thursday, then came the big deal this past weekend. Joni Ernst's roast and ride on June 3rd at the Iowa State Fairgrounds in Des Moines. And again, we're going to talk about briefly each of the candidates who showed up. The only one who really didn't was Donald Trump. But they all largely refrained from attacking each other and Trump. So I wonder, how can that possibly be a winning strategy?
I want to say that even though Donald Trump wasn't present, I felt that the shadow of Donald Trump was very palpable. I was not there in person. I watched the event later on C-SPAN, but from the several remarks, and also even Senator Chuck Grassley spoke before any of the presidential candidates, and he spent a lot of his time up there talking about the deep state and the FBI and how they had it in for Donald Trump, and they buried the criminal investigations into Hunter Biden and all of this business. So it almost felt as if it was the kind of speech that Trump would give, right? The airing of grievances. So I thought that was very striking. So yes, Donald Trump, I mean, you could tell that in front of that large Republican audience that the other candidates, nobody really wanted to go to war with Donald Trump there.
Right. All right. We've already talked about Ron DeSantis. He did show up at the roast and ride. He said, "I don't make idle promises when I get into office that I will forget. I will lean into all the issues that matter." But Nikki Haley said, "I'm not going to do a rally and leave you." So that was kind of an indirect reference to Donald Trump.
It was. And I do want to say that toward the end of Ron DeSantis's speech, and they were arranged, I don't know who determined the speaking order, but they ended with Ron DeSantis. I think they didn't want to have him early in the speaking order and have a lot of people leave after he had spoken. So he said, after outlining a lot of the things that he's done in Florida and things that he'd like to do nationally, he said, Ron DeSantis said, "You can't do any of it if you don't win. There is no substitute for victory, and we need to dispense with the culture of losing that has beset the Republican Party in recent years." And so this is something that he's said at other events in Iowa. And the problem is that a lot of Donald Trump supporters don't believe that he lost the 2020 election. So it's very difficult to say we have to get away from the culture of losing when people don't really believe that they lost. So I think that's tricky. You're correct, Nikki Haley. I mean, she did try. She said that she wasn't going to do shortcuts. She's not going to do a rally and leave. She'll answer every question. And then she also said, which I thought was very interesting, don't complain about what you get in a general if you don't play in this caucus, because it matters. And I thought that was maybe a little bit too subtle. But the way I received that message is, be careful not to nominate an unelectable candidate. But again, she never really said that Donald Trump lost the election, and she didn't say Donald Trump couldn't win the election next year. So that is just a very tricky line to walk.
Former Vice President Mike Pence was there. In fact, he was the only one who rode a motorcycle during the event. He filed his paperwork on this Monday afternoon as we go live to officially join the presidential race. It was absolutely no surprise. He's going to launch his campaign Wednesday in Des Moines. It's hard to see, honestly, where he has a lane in this, even if he's on a motorcycle.
Yes. And he has been at the Roast and Ride before, and he did ride a motorcycle before. A lot of the politicians who come to speak at this event do not ride a motorcycle, but Mike Pence apparently is an avid motorcyclist. So, yes. And I saw him the previous week. We didn't have a show on Memorial Day, so we didn't get a chance to talk about it. But I went to Mike Pence's event at the Des Moines Christian School. And yeah, like you say, it is hard to see a lane. I mean, he spent a lot of his time at the Roast and Ride talking about the accomplishments of the Trump administration. But the problem is that Donald Trump is still running, right? So that doesn't give people a reason. If the Trump administration was so great and Mike Pence was proud to be part of it, why should people support him and not Donald Trump? He did say, again, in what was kind of a vague reference, he said, we need to resist the politics of personality and the siren song of populism unmoored to conservative principles. Okay. So I think that's a reference to Donald Trump, but like, I don't really know how the average caucus goer is going to hear that and say, oh yeah, right. Okay. I guess I better not caucus for the siren song of populism. You know, I mean, that is just, I don't really see it. So, I mean, Mike Pence obviously going very much for the evangelical vote, but so are all the other candidates. And Donald Trump still hasn't entirely lost evangelical support. So I just don't know about Mike Pence.
There were five other candidates who showed up. Perry Johnson, Michigan businessman, Asa Hutchinson, the former Arkansas governor, Vivek Ramaswamy, businessman, Larry Elder, talk show host, Tim Scott, South Carolina senator. We can briefly summarize all of them by saying, basically, they did not criticize Trump directly. They're all trying to get their little niche of the action, but it's, again, hard to see how big those niches are.
I still believe that Tim Scott is basically running for vice president. That is how I see it. The way he doesn't really say anything that goes against anything that Donald Trump or Ron DeSantis are doing. Asa Hutchinson, obviously, there's no lane, right? He has been the most critical of Trump in other venues, but he wasn't at the Roast and Ride. The Larry Elder, the talk show host, I mean, he got a big laugh at the beginning when he said, say hello to the black face of white supremacy. And he spent a lot of his speech talking about critical race theory and other things being bad. And those are good applause lines. But again, I don't know how many people are going to caucus for him. Vivek Ramaswamy, I see as kind of like the Pete Buttigieg of this field. He is the youngest candidate by far. He is talking about the future. And I think that he's angling for some kind of a job in the next Republican administration. And lastly, Perry Johnson. I mean, this just made me laugh. I don't know why some candidates do this, but he had this kind of phony, self-deprecating. He said, well, I'm probably too conservative for this group. And then later he said, well, I know you're not going to like this, but I'm going to get rid of the Department of Education, which, of course, he knows is a popular position because Republicans have been talking about getting rid of the Department of Education since the 1980s. So I don't know why he would say that. But Perry Johnson, Larry Elder, they're going to have trouble. And Asa Hutchinson, they're probably going to have trouble qualifying for the Republican debates. I think that it looks like Tim Scott and Vivek Ramaswamy are probably going to be on the debate stage. And that's maybe an opportunity for them. But I just see them auditioning for a job in the next Republican administration and not really as contenders for the nomination.
Right. That debate is going to be held on August 23rd. We don't know who's going to qualify, because to qualify, candidates have to have 1% in three national polls or two national polls plus one state poll or fundraising with 40,000 individual donors. Look, a few of those candidates, we know that DeSantis will be there and Trump will be there. It's completely up. I don't know who else is going to be
there.
Well,
Nikki Haley and Tim Scott claim that they are going to easily have the 40,000 donors. And so does Vivek Ramaswamy. He's done a lot of focus on asking people to give him $1 and $3. This can be very expensive. The DNC had similar debate criteria in 2019, and it was hard for some of the candidates. They had to spend a lot of money just to generate a lot of small dollar donors. So you end up spending more money than you're actually taking in.
And one more bit on the Republicans here. We're going to get some more candidates coming in this week. Former New Jersey Governor Chris Christie, expected to jump into the race tomorrow merely as an attack dog. He apparently wants to savage Trump.
Yes. And it looks like he's going to mainly be competing in New Hampshire. I mean, I don't think he's going to spend a lot of time in Iowa. He probably will come to Iowa, but I don't see him really planting his flag here in the Iowa caucuses.
And here's a name that most people listening tonight probably have never heard of, Doug Burgum. I could give you a second to try to look it up, but I don't want you to look it up. Doug Burgum is going to announce he's running on Wednesday. Laura, you reveal it. Who is Doug Burgum?
I admit that I did not know this prior to seeing the news that about his announcement. He is the governor of North Dakota. So, I mean, I found that a little bit strange. A lot of people see themselves as a future president. So here you go. I don't know how he's going to get 1% in the polls and 40,000 unique donors, especially since North Dakota is one of the lower population states. But, you know, there is more joining the party.
Yeah. Well, I mean, Doug Burgum is no Ryan Binkley, who's one of my favorites that nobody's ever heard of. Okay, and New Hampshire Governor Chris Sununu, who had been making noise for a long time about maybe jumping in as a protest candidate against Trump, he decided today, he announced that he is not running for president.
That's right. And I think that makes sense, because if you have the governor of New Hampshire, that could end up discouraging candidates from coming and campaigning in New Hampshire, which is not what anybody up there wants. And there's not really a lane for Chris Sununu. I mean, the moderate New England Republican is a brand that works really well in New England, but it doesn't really translate to the rest of the Republican Party, where most of the delegates are that determine who becomes the presidential nominee.
Let's quickly identify ourselves. 17 and a half. No, it's not. It's 16 and a half after the hour. We've got to get this time right. 16 and 44 seconds after the hour. This is KHY's Capital Week with Laura Bellin and me, Dennis Hart. Capital Week, we are, to use a phrase from Mike Pence, your siren song for everything political going on in Iowa. We're every week at this time to talk about what's been happening in and around the state capitol and what it all means, the siren song. Okay, Democrats. Talk about how crowded the Republican thing is. The Democrats decided to do something with their caucus over the weekend. It's going to be potentially difficult, a mess. It may create national problems with New Hampshire. Let's talk about this.
Well, I think actually the Iowa Democratic Party found a way to square the circle here. What happened is the State Central Committee, which is the governing body, they unanimously on Saturday approved the draft delegate selection plan. The delegate selection plan is what outlines how the Iowa caucuses are going to be conducted and the whole caucus to convention process that culminates in the state convention where delegates are going to be elected to the DNC. And remember that we don't expect any serious opposition to Joe Biden here, but it's very important for Iowa Democrats. They have three competing goals, right? The DNC is telling them caucuses have to be more inclusive, and also Iowa is no longer in that early state window. State law is telling them you have to have caucuses on the same day as the Republican Party, and also under a new law that the governor just signed, they have to have in-person caucuses if they're going to do presidential selection. And then you have New Hampshire that says anything that seems like a mail-in ballot is too much like a primary, and they don't want that to happen before the New Hampshire primary because their state law says they have the first primary. So I just don't want to go into too much detail about the Democratic Party's plan, but the upshot is it's very much like what we have talked about in the past, what John Deeth and others have suggested, that they hold in-person caucuses on the same night as Republicans, 8 days before the New Hampshire primary. But they don't do presidential candidate selection at those caucuses. Those caucuses will deal with other party business, platform resolutions, electing county central committee members, and so on, and electing county convention delegates. And then later, the Iowa Democratic Party is going to administer some kind of mail-in. It's not going to be exactly a ballot, but it's going to be a presidential preference card, and the results are going to be announced at a later date, not specified in this plan. So that might satisfy the DNC, because that's going to be outside that early state window, most likely. And it might satisfy New Hampshire because this mail-in process is not going to be occurring, or at least the results won't be announced prior to the New Hampshire primary. So I think this is actually a very clever plan.
Now, for somebody who didn't want to go in depth, I think you just dug pretty deep here on this. We'll excuse you on that, though. We'd like to be able to tell you, since Laura and I really like breaking news on this broadcast, and we've done it many times, we'd like to be able to tell you when those caucuses are going to be. But here's the deal. No one knows.
No one knows it. The date has not been set. It's just they've determined it will happen at the same time as the Republican Party. And remember, we talked about how the Republicans have said they're looking at mid-January. The Democrats are not going to want it to happen on January 15th, which is MLK Day. However, because they are doing the presidential preferences at a later time and using this mail-in preference card, that might mitigate some of those problems somewhat, because people, it won't be as big a deal if you can't attend your in-person caucus. You'll still be able to express your views on the presidential candidate. And of course, it's almost going to be a formality this time, because Joe Biden is certainly going to win the delegates from the Iowa delegation. But in any case, this is just a way for the Iowa Democratic Party to try to show the DNC, we're trying to be more inclusive, we're trying to follow your rules, also trying to comply with state law. And so I think it's very interesting.
We have plenty more to talk about tonight, but time is fleeting. So we're going to go right on to the national debt ceiling. That crisis that we'd heard about for weeks, months, was averted last week. The U.S. House and Senate overwhelmingly voted to suspend the nation's borrowing limit through next year, set caps on discretionary spending. It was not closed. The House approved it 314 to 117. The Senate approved it 63 to 36. Here's the interesting thing for Iowa. All six, Laura, of Iowa's Republican House and Senate members voted in favor of that bill.
And I went back as far as I could with the records, congressional records, up to about 1977. And there had never been another debt ceiling increase. The debt ceiling has been increased dozens of times, but there had never been a debt ceiling increase that every single person in the Iowa delegation voted for prior to last week. And it was interesting. The House members from Iowa, they were a little bit cagey. I mean, the deal was announced over Memorial Day weekend, and a lot of members of Congress came out right away to say whether they would be voting for it or not. Iowa's four members of Congress, I was checking their social media every day, checking their news releases, and they didn't say anything about it until after the vote. Then they all released statements explaining why they thought this was important, that it reduced spending levels and so on, averted the catastrophe. But they were a little bit cagey about it. But yes, but both Senator Grassley and Ernst voted for it. That's unusual. It's the first time Joni Ernst has ever voted to raise the debt ceiling while a Democrat is president. And Chuck Grassley, in his long congressional career, had only one previous time voted to raise the debt ceiling while a Democrat was president.
All right. In the few minutes we have left, we're going to talk about the governor signing a few bills into law last week, 65 to be exact. No, we're not talking about all 65. Do not tune out. We're just going to talk about some of the most important, one of the most important, a bill that Rob Sand, the state auditor, just hates. It's restricting his powers from here on.
Yes, he has called it repeatedly. He said it's the most pro-corruption bill in Iowa history. This is the bill that says that state agencies will be able to basically decide whether certain materials are relevant to an investigation by the state auditor. And if the state auditor wants to obtain documents that he can't get, instead of being able to go to court to enforce a subpoena, which is what has long been the case in Iowa, he has to go to a three-member arbitration panel where one member is appointed by the governor's office, one by the state auditor's office, and one by the agency being audited. So clearly, the governor could basically have a veto over any investigation that the state auditor is doing. So this was very controversial. It passed along party lines in the Iowa Senate. As we talked about earlier, there were six Iowa House Republicans who voted against it. And of course, all the Democrats in both chambers voted against it. But that's going to be very impactful. And Rob Sand has been very outspoken about this bill, and I'm sure he's going to continue to do that.
The only Democrat elected to a statewide office in last year's election, and he's being punished for it right now. The governor also signed into law a requirement that Iowa families receiving food assistance face a new asset test before they can get those benefits.
Yeah, so this is, we've talked about this. This is the federal food assistance that's known as SNAP. Many people still call it food stamps. But now the asset test is going to be that the household has to have no more than $15,000 in assets. That's excluding the value of the home, one vehicle, and a second vehicle if it's worth less than $10,000. The people, the advocates in the food bank community had been urging the governor to veto this, but I don't think anybody ever had any doubt that the governor was going to sign it. But she certainly didn't have a big public ceremony when she signed it. This was something that she signed at the last possible moment and then buried in a long press release with lots of other bill signings.
And the governor also signed the state's $8.5 billion budget. She was always going to do that. We've talked about that before. Let's go down to this sweeping education law that she signed. This is a really big deal. It was one of the key points the state legislature was aiming at all session.
Yes, and this was, she signed several education bills on the Friday before Memorial Day. And this includes the ban on any instruction about sexual orientation or gender identity from grades kindergarten through six. It includes the ban on school library or classroom materials that contain any description of a sex act. It removes from the mandatory curriculum teaching about HIV or HPV. And also, I mean, there's just a lot to that bill. Other bills also reduce the curriculum requirements. There are new transparency requirements for schools that they have to publish. They have to make it easier for parents to file complaints about curriculum materials. And so it's really going to change public education. I think this was probably the most impactful legislative session for public education since the early 1970s when the state legislature changed the school funding formula.
And one more bill the governor signed into law, a bill that lets Iowa teenagers work longer hours and take jobs that were previously banned. This one gained national attention.
Yes, it did. And this was one that she signed late on Friday afternoon, got the press release at 4:43 p.m. on the Friday before Memorial Day. So you know that that's something they don't want to get a lot of attention. So there's a lot to this bill. It did change. It was not quite as severe as the initial version. It changed a lot as it was moving through the Iowa House and went back to the Senate. But it extends the hours that 14-year-olds can work. It extends how late the shifts they can work are. And in some ways, that violates the U.S. Department of Labor standards. So we're going to have to see how that plays out. It allows 16 and 17-year-olds to serve alcohol in restaurants if parents give permission. And there are certain other things, but those are probably the main things. There are certain occupations that were considered dangerous occupations where now there will be waivers that allow 16 and 17-year-olds to work in those. So one example would be roofing. Another example would be building demolition. And so there are some questions as well about the compliance with federal law with that.
And finally, tonight, in our last couple of minutes here, the governor announced last week that she's going to send troops to the border of Mexico, 100 National Guard troops, 30 Department of Public Safety employees to the U.S.-Mexico border this summer, all at the request of Texas Governor Greg Abbott, who wants to make a big show of getting a force down there because Greg Abbott doesn't believe the Biden administration is doing nearly enough to stop the immigrants from coming in.
I was very intrigued by this. And of course, I haven't been able to get any answers out of the Department of Public Safety. But at the last moment before the justice system's budget was passed, there was a last minute change that moved about $1 million over from the judicial branch budget to the Department of Public Safety, which already was getting a budget increase. So I am wondering whether the governor already had in mind that she was planning to announce this deployment, because this is a lot. 100 Iowa National Guard troops for the entire month of August, and then 30 Department of Public Safety employees for the entire month of September. That's a lot. It cost in 2021, it cost $300,000 just to send 28 troopers down to Texas for 2 weeks.
Yes. Are you still there, Laura?
I am. I'm sorry.
Okay.
I had to take a drink of water.
All right. Laura, recovering from, we should say, the coronavirus, and also with a big dog on her lap right now, Sammy the dog that we can see on Zoom. So, Laura, I'll continue here and jump in when you can. The governor is one of 13 Republican governors who have agreed to send troops to the border in Texas this summer, again at the request of Greg Abbott. And a lot of folks are saying this is nothing more than a political stunt. That probably is a fair interpretation on one side of the political spectrum. But the governor, obviously, she's done it before. She believes that this is somehow going to help her and put in, you know, a poll into the back of President Biden, shall we say.
Well, and she mentioned it in her brief remarks at the Roast and Ride event. Several Republican candidates talked about the need to secure the border. This is a very popular position in Republican circles, and she has repeatedly said that it's very important to help intercept people crossing the border. She's also tied that to the flow of fentanyl and overdose deaths in Iowa. So we'll see. But I think this is going to be a very expensive deployment. And I'm curious to see where the money comes from. And like I said, it makes me wonder whether that last minute budget increase, that was not mentioned during the Iowa legislative debates on that budget. But I wonder if this was the intention.
Well, Laura, get another drink of water. I'm going to take it from here. We only have a few seconds left. We will be back here next week. And Laura, I'm looking forward to seeing. We're going to have a new presidential candidate in there, a couple of them, et cetera. And we're going to have a quiz because those who didn't hear it, who is Doug Burgum? That'll be our question next week.
That's right. I'll be watching.
That's it. We are out of time for this edition of Capital Week. A reminder that the views and opinions expressed here did not necessarily reflect the opinions of KHOI or its staff. Laura and I will be back next week in this time slot, so will Sammy the dog, when we'll talk about everything interesting, important, or entertaining about politics Iowa style. As always, we hope you can join us. Thank you so much for the privilege of your time. We appreciate it, and we do value it. Between now and next time, we hope you have a safe, healthy, and very happy week.